Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. More and more people these days are becoming aware of this practice, of Zen practice. After being here for about 50 years and being very much invisible, it's now emerging, and people are beginning to explore and read and question and engage in the practice. And what we notice, not just in our own practice, but in everybody else's practice, the biggest question is, now that I've found this practice, and it feels right, how can I take it into my daily life? This is the question. I think this is the most frequently asked question that people have, and it's something that we talk about here almost all the time. Our experience is that when we do zazen, when we sit in meditation here, our mind is calm, clear, and we feel very attentive when we sit in zazen. But then we have to go back out into the everyday world. We have to go back to work, or we have to go to school. We have to go on the street. We have to be with our family. And it feels like we lose it. People use that expression all the time. You know, a zazen is wonderful, but then I go to out there and I lose it. Lose it. It feels like that. We lose it. And what that really means, what people really mean by that is that stress comes up, anxiety arises, we start to feel impatient about things, we get irritated, and anger arises. And so it seems that, well, our experience is that zazen mind is very elusive in our daily lives. So that's what I would like to explore tonight. Why is that? I think we lose zazen mind because we see zazen as a task. When we first start to practice, we don't see zazen for what it truly is. Instead, we see it as a task. We see it as one more thing to do on our to-do list. This is, I think, our problem. Our busy lives are oriented in a very, linear way. Well, first I'm going to do this, and then I have to do that, and then I'll do zazen, and then I'll do the next thing. So we see zazen as one of many activities and as one of many ordinary activities, one of many. And like every ordinary activity in our life, there is a goal and a start time and a stop time. And today we have electronic devices to help us with our start times and start times. This is a new wrinkle. In other words, when we first come to zazen, we see it, we feel that it is something we have to manage. How do I fit it in? When do I start? When do I stop? How do we manage it? So our difficulty is zazen feels part of a long string of tasks that we have to take care of. This is the misunderstanding. And we feel like the way we take care of all of our ordinary tasks, we feel a sense of responsibility to do it well, whatever that means, and to be successful in it, whatever that may mean. And if we see our meditation practice, if we see our zazen practice in that way, it becomes a burden. And I think that's why many people have trouble staying. It's just one more burden. I don't need one more burden. So if we are to become comfortable with our practice, if we are to embrace it fully, we need to reorient our view, our initial view of the practice. We have to see zazen not as a burden, but as a gift. We need to shift our attitude. And this can happen naturally for many people with some practice. But for many people, they become impatient that zazen never gets past the feeling of being a burden. If we look at our life carefully, through the eyes of our practice, we come to realize that our life is not a collection of activities like we think. Life is not a collection of activities with each one totally separate from the others, like beads on a string. All activities strung together to make a life. In the same way, our existence, our life, is not like a roll of paper towels that you find in the kitchen. In other words, paper towels, when you have used the last one, there's nothing left. Our life is not like that. Nothing left. Rather, our life and our existence is more like a garden. Metaphor that you've heard quite a bit when it comes to talking about our practice and about Buddhism. Our life is like a garden. And our role in working with this garden is to prepare the soil so that things can grow in their own way. And each thing that grows in the garden grows in its own unique way. So our job in our life is to establish a foundation for things to grow. But we have to be careful of not managing this growth moment by moment, minute by minute, as we manage the tasks in our everyday life. We shouldn't try to manage our whole life that way. Our practice is to allow the activities of life to grow and sprout out of our true nature, out of our fundamental being. And we need to see our life and our existence not as something flat. Too often we see our life as flat, as a paper towel from the roll, like this. We use the paper towel and then we toss it away. Our life is not like that. It's not flat like this. Our life and our existence in the relative world, in the everyday world, our life has three dimensions, we say. But in the spiritual world, our life and our existence has 10 dimensions. 10 dimensions. In other words, an infinite number of dimensions, enabling our life to reach everywhere and to be expressed fully and to include everything. So through our practice, as it matures, we come to understand that the activities of our life are supported by our understanding of our true nature and of who we are in a very, very large sense. Many people come through this door for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's college students become because it's an assignment. A couple of weeks ago, we had a dozen students from Santa Clara come because they have to come here and write a paper. Well, other people come because they've heard about Zen practice and they want to know more and they're curious. Others have this notion of what we call cool. Zen practice is cool. I want to do that. Despite all of those various reasons, there's a fundamental reason why people come. And that is because they do feel that something is missing. Something missing in this busy life. And they're trying to find out what that is. And it's as if their life has become a card game, a game of cards. And that the cards that they have been dealt do not constitute a full hand. Something is missing in the hand they've been dealt with. There's an empty space. And they feel the need for something that will fill that space. So our intellect and our energy and our vision that bring us to the practice are not enough to fill that empty space. You think it would be. Intellect, energy, vision, not enough to fill the space. They may provide us with temporary satisfaction, but they can create a difficulty for us if we do them, if our doing of the things in our life are limited to achieving a goal, achieving various goals. And we see that all around in the modern world. There's intellect, and there's energy, and there's vision. We're overflowing with it here. And we're using them almost primarily to achieve various goals and to create progress. So the problem that we have these days in the world, the reason why we have so many problems these days is that we put so much emphasis on what we call achievement or achieving. I have to use my capacities to achieve something. We forget the importance of putting our emphasis on the activity itself, not on the result. We need to put our emphasis on the doing, not on the goal. So if we are to have peace of mind and enjoy our life and fully embrace it, we have to change, we have to reorient our mind and change our attitude to what we're doing. Now, when you have been involved in Zen practice for time, especially if you come here for the activities that we do to take care of this place, you know, activities other than being on the cushion, you discover that our practice emphasizes what we might call useless activities, where there's nothing to achieve, no goals, and there's no dollar value we can place on it. And this is very clear, this becomes very obvious when you visit Japan and you observe the culture and you observe what happens in the monasteries. For example, if you go to an archery exhibit in Japan, you notice that there's no bullseye. There's a big target, with lots of stuffing in it, and the archer shoots at the target, but there's no bullseye. And there is no scorecard. The emphasis is not on some goal, it is on the doing. It is on the activity itself. And another well-known activity in the Japanese culture is the tea ceremony, a very formal and ritualized tea ceremony where the individual preparing the tea takes a long time to do it very carefully and very meticulously. And when the tea is prepared in a special cup that's probably been made by a famous potter and has some very interesting glaze marks on it, these teacups all contain what is known as a sweet spot, a place on the cup that is supposed to be the most attractive and the most beautiful, some spot. And when the server presents the cup of tea to her guest or his guest, she always orients the teacup so that the sweet spot is facing the guest as an act of courtesy. So the guest is presented with this teacup and the sweet spot is facing them. And the guest always goes through the ritual of just admiring the cup and looking at the sweet spot. But in our everyday situations, in our daily life, it's hard to see the sweet spot. What if your everyday situation does not show you a sweet spot? What if what's presented to you is confusion and not a piece of art? When this happens, and it happens all the time, we have to discover what is the best way. We have to ask ourselves, what is the sweet spot in this situation? How can I find a sweet spot to present to my guest? And you may be in a discussion with someone, a negotiation, an argument. If you say to yourself, how can I find a sweet spot to present to this other person? How do I take care of my guest? Well, we don't do that in this culture. Instead, we think of strategies to defeat the other person. That's our culture. But our practice tells us, find the sweet spot, create the sweet spot, so that your relationship with this other person can go well. This is the secret of our practice. These activities, archery with no goal, no scorecard, Zen ceremony, with the sweet spot. There's no goal in these activities. Because our spiritual dimension has no goal, our true nature has no goal. So our practice is simply to take care of each activity for its own sake without striving for achievement. And this way of life, this orientation towards life, becomes very natural when we have a continuous practice. As you probably know, Zen emphasizes doing things without words, with as few words as possible, and without being asked or reminded to do something. To do things, to respond to life naturally, to notice what there is to be done without somebody telling us. We do things according to the situation as we recognize it. And there is no holding back or waiting to be prompted. So if we are going to meet our friends over at the Starbucks over here, we park our car and we're walking across the parking lot and we see somebody's thrown their cup, their paper cup on the ground, we pick it up and take it to the trash. Nobody has to tell us. Nobody has to remind us that that's what we should do. So our practice teaches us, reminds us to pay attention to the non-verbal world, to the non-technical world. And we discover that it is the joyous way to live. Years ago, I came across a story, Zen story, from the golden age of Zen, 9th century, that continually comes back to me. And I'd like to read it to you verbatim now. It's a story about Zen master Kuai Shan, who lived right around he lived between the 7th and 8th centuries. I think he passed away in 811. This is the golden age of Zen. And he is the master in this story. So the story goes that one day, as the master was lying on his bed, his disciple, Yang Shan, approached and asked how he was. The master got up and said, "I've just had a dream. Please interpret it for me." Yang Shan got up, went out, and brought back a basin of water so his teacher could wash his face on a warm day. A little later, another disciple, Xiang Yan, also came and asked the master how he was. And Kuai Shan said, "A moment ago I had a dream, and Yang Shan here interpreted it for me. Can you explain it?" Immediately, Xiang Yan went out and came back with a bowl of tea for his teacher. The master said, "You too can interpret better than Shariputra." That's the story. Shariputra was known as Buddha's wisest disciple. He understood everything. "You too can interpret better than Shariputra," which is another way of saying, you really get it. You understand. So in this story, of course, the master, Kuai Shan, tests his student by saying, "I have this dream. Why don't you interpret it for me?" And they don't bite. They don't get involved in some kind of verbal discussion. They see what's needed or what is useful, and they take care of it. One brings a bowl of water, and a cloth, and the other brings a cup of tea. So their spontaneous actions are beyond the verbal world, the intellectual world. Spontaneous and natural, the sweet spot. They create a sweet spot in the midst of a confusing situation, a situation that could be confusing if they started to interpret some dream that probably never happened. So we try to cultivate this kind of attitude in our everyday life with each other. So we listen, we watch, and we reflect on the question, what needs to be done here? When we have that orientation, our mind is open and it's ready and it's attentive and it's calm. It is the Zazen mind in everyday life. And when we live our life like that, the activities of our life are not separate. Instead, our life is one continuous stream. What's happening these days, what needs to happen these days, is we need to revive our spontaneity and our naturalness with each other in the modern world. Too much emphasis on technical progress. And that makes the mind very narrow. And there's no room for our spiritual side. If we are too much taken up with progress. We develop a feeling of freedom in our life when we learn to take care of each other and learn to take care of all things in the world that support us. A garden will not support us with food if we don't take care of it. With a giving attitude and without hesitation. And where does this feeling of freedom come from? When we take care of each other? It's because inherently our true nature is giving. Originally, our true nature is of a giving nature. We have to return to our true nature and learn to give to each other. Our existence, our life, is one continuous gift of giving. And we should arrange our life according to our true nature and not according to what our society tells us is important. Because we can be misled by that. We have to discover for ourselves how to arrange our life according to who we truly are. The Buddhist teachings tell us that human beings do not create enlightenment. But our enlightenment does not manifest itself without our effort. It is like a candle in a dark room. We have to make some effort to light the candle. When we do, things appear. Things appear out of the dark. Things that were always there. And with our effort, they can show themselves. And this is our practice. Does anyone have a question? Or a story? Yes, Dave.
Les, at the beginning of your talk, you discussed the misunderstanding that sitting Zazen is just a task, just a burden. And it reminded me of something that came up last year in one of the introduction to Zen classes or discussions. Somebody said, oh, so it sounds like Zazen should be a high priority. And we sort of talked about that and really came to the conclusion that that really wasn't the right way to look at it. Because if you think about it, prioritization is a tool that you use when you have too many things to do and you can't do them all. And what you're really doing when you prioritize something is defining the circumstances under which you won't do it. What's the priority of breathing? There are things that we just don't assign priorities to, and Zazen should be one of those. Anyway, that was the conclusion we came to, and I was reminded of that by what you said. So thank you.
That is a good point. It feels like we should make Zazen an important element of our day, but we need to find a different way to frame it, to see it, not something to be placed at the top of the list of the things to do, but sort of overall. And this is, I think, one of the good reasons for starting our day with Zazen before we do anything else. We don't have to prioritize. It's just, that's what I do when I get up. Don't have to think about it. Don't have to look at my list. That's what I do. So you make a good point. We should be careful of bringing these management techniques to our practice. Thank you. Has anybody ever experienced the tea ceremony, Japanese tea ceremony? What was your feeling about?
You had to be there for me to share my feeling.
You have to be there. Yeah. Okay. It's good. Good point. Thank you. I remember the first time I saw an exhibition of Japanese archery, and this bowman shot the arrow into a bale of hay, and everybody applauded. And I thought, what? Did he hit a bullseye? What? I really didn't understand what he was doing. Bale of hay. Everybody's applauding. Yes, please.
I got the feeling that by just responding to what needs to be done, that there's something kind of more random about that outcome. And I just wondered if it was because it's not important or there's something divinely clear that it's right if you just get out of the way. Just left me thinking what you're going to end up doing could be less planned. And what does that mean?
Let me see if I understand the beginning of your question. When we respond to something, would you say randomly, or how did you say it? When we respond to situation spontaneously based on what we perceive needs to be done or would be useful, we are expressing an attitude of taking care. Even though there's no measurement of the result, there's no value we can assign to it, you take out the trash because it's a way of taking care. If people didn't take out the trash, we have a mess. So we take care of each other and we take care of our environment when we take out the trash. because we sense that this needs to be done. And it's an act of taking care. And this is... This is the source of our enlightenment. This spontaneous taking care of what needs to be done. Yes, Richard.
Is Zen like a countercultural force against a dominant culture, or is it somehow compatible? These two cultures seem sort of incompatible in some way. Anyway, huh. I don't know. What do you think about that?
You know, when the baby cries, a mom, hearing her baby cry, will go spontaneously to see what she can do or to see what the baby needs. And if the crying of the baby, the reason is not obvious, the mom will pick up the baby and simply provide support, provide nurturing, assure the baby that she's safe and all those things, just by holding and being natural. There's nothing really logical about that. That's just spontaneous and loving. So if we say, you know, our whole culture should have more of that in it, we should treat each other a little bit like that. When we hear the cries of the world or somebody is a little bit upset, let's approach them with the mind of a giving mother. Now, that idea, you know, probably won't fly in this culture. What? That's weak, that's soft. Leave mothering to moms. Don't talk about that in daily life. So it seems like those are incompatible activities. But when we think about it, there is nothing preventing us from treating each other with that kind of attitude. To be softer to each other, to be warmer, more caring. We could do that. We could each be kind of a, not exactly a parent for each other, but a good friend when we see that a good friend is needed. So I don't think it's incompatible. It's just that we've convinced ourselves in some way that that's kind of weak. You don't do that in the real world. You don't do that. But I don't think they're incompatible. I think we need to learn... We need to revive that idea. Anyway, that's my feeling.
My question is, you know, when you're still starting out, you don't know if your judgment is necessarily the right thing to do or it won't cause harm. Like, I'm reminded of, like, in, you know, the European expansion in, like, the 1600s, 1700s, you had these missionaries going around all over the world. And, you know, they really believed in their, you know, their cause of spreading, you know, their religion. But in the process of kind of these good intentions, they ended up, you know, messing up a lot of local cultures, you know, forcing things that they didn't want, these local cultures didn't want. So how do you approach, you know, kind of just, you don't have the perfect understanding of what your actions will do?
I think we have to be careful about trying to make change in the world until we have some experience in the world so that we have an understanding of how things go. We have a sense of what might be the outcome or the impact if I take this action. Are there some... I need to think about what are the unintended consequences. So that takes some experience to develop that, you know, that wisdom. So that's generally known as the big picture. And to go along with that, we have to care. We have to care that we don't create harm. And in the world, in the goal-oriented world that we have, that can become a real problem if we are part of some activity and people can see progress and gain and benefit, and you say, well, you know, but that, maybe we should do that, it'll create harm, and you may be kicked off the team if you talk like that, you know? So it's, we have to be clever, we have to be skillful in doing things in a way that doesn't create harm, but still meets some expectations. It's a very, your question is, there's no easy answer. We just have to look at it carefully in each situation. That's our challenge. Your question is really what our challenge is every day in helping our society to improve and at the same time not messing it up. And that's tricky. Thank you.
I have a question about what you mentioned about Sasen not having a goal and this practice not being goal-oriented. And the story that you read about the golden age of Zen, where the master is kind of testing his students. And that, you know, those kind of stories are pretty common. And I wonder if that could seem a little bit goal-oriented in the sense that, you know, there is some understanding to achieve and some students get the understanding, other students don't get the understanding. So doesn't that seem a little bit goal-oriented?
Yes. And there are different schools of Zen, and they use various techniques or methods to try to push the student to understanding. In our school, the Soto school, we don't do that. No pushing, no difficult questions. The story that I told came from a school that no longer exists. And there were, at one point, five schools of Chinese Zen, and they all had different ways of pushing the student. But in our school, you're correct. I think they understand that it's too much goal-oriented. Leave the student alone. Just provide an environment for the student to find their own way. Don't push them in a certain direction. So the stories of from the golden age of Zen are very interesting. But, you know, that's not what we practice today.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.